Box A, the protected keyword. So, we are already familiar with the public and private keyword when used in a class. They define how class members can be accessed outside a class. We know that private means that a class member can only be accessed inside that class's implementation. This is true for inheritance as well. That is, if a class D inherits private members from a class B, the class D cannot access those members. The example in box A illustrates this. The class B has a private method foo. Recall a class is private by default, and we do not specify the public keyword in B. Then a class D inherits from B. Class B has a method bar, which calls the inherited private method foo. Inside main, we invoke bar. However, this produces an error. Cannot access private member declared in class B. The problem is that foo is private, and so even an inherited class cannot access it. Sometimes this is desirable if the class designer wants to ensure a class member is not accessed even in derived classes, but this is not always the case. So how to make a class member accessible to a derived class? We could make the class member public, but then the member would be publicly accessible everywhere, which may not be desirable. What we want is sort of a quasi-private keyword, one where the class members are private, except that they can be accessed by derived classes. The protected keyword is provided exactly for this purpose. As an exercise, insert the protected keyword followed by a colon above the foo method in class B and recompile the program. You should not get any errors this time. Box B, example. Here we look at a simple class hierarchy. Note that only the class definitions are shown and the implementations have been omitted. So first we define a general spaceship class, which contains class members that are general to all spaceships. We say that all spaceships can fly, all spaceships have a 3D position in space, all ships have an amount of fuel, and all ships have a damage property. Note that this is by no means a complete list, but will suffice for illustration purposes. We then define two kinds of spaceships, a fighter ship and a bomber ship. These are spaceships, so they share the properties that are in common to all spaceships, namely, they can fly, have a position, have fuel, and a damage level. Instead of duplicating all this code in each class, these classes can inherit all the code from the more general spaceship class. We see the inheritance syntax in bold in the box. In addition to inheriting the general functionality, each class also adds its specific class members. For example, the fighter ship adds a fire missile method and a variable to count how many missiles the ship has left. Similarly, the bomber ship adds a drop bomb method and a variable to count how many bombs the ship has left. So hopefully this gives you an idea of the usefulness of inheritance. Many real-world objects can be generalized, and by creating an inheritance hierarchy, you can save a lot of redundancy by reusing code through inheritance. Not only does this reuse code, but it makes maintenance faster as well. Suppose you didn't use inheritance and you reduplicated a lot of code. Then suppose that you needed to make a change to that code. You would have to go and make all the changes class by class. But if you used inheritance, you would make the change in just one class, and all the classes that inherit from that class would inherit the change as well. Box C, inheritance diagrams. Inheritance relationships are often depicted graphically as shown in box C. The figure says that fighter ship and bomber ship inherit from spaceship. Box D, member initialization lists. We know that objects can be initialized in the constructor. That is, the constructor is called when an object is created and can be used to initialize the object. Previously, we always wrote the initialization code inside the constructor body. However, there is an alternative way called a member initialization list. So consider the concrete example with the fighter ship constructor at the bottom of box D. Notice that the member initialization list comes before the constructor body. The first line calls the base constructor. As you will see in a later slide, a derived object has a base part, which is the part that was inherited. So to construct the base part, we need to call the base constructor in the member initialization list. After we have constructed the base part, we proceed to finish constructing the derived part, which is initializing the number of missiles counter in this example. Finally, since we did all the constructing in the member initialization list, our constructor body can be left empty. Note that you must call the base constructor in the member initialization list, but it is not required to initialize the derived part in the member initialization list, although there are performance implications. Scott Myers points out in Effective C++ that by using a member initialization list, we only do one operation, construction. If we do not use a member initialization list, we end up doing two operations. One, construction to a default value, and two, an assignment in the constructor body. So by using a member initialization list, we can reduce two operations into one. Such a reduction becomes significant with large classes and with large arrays of classes. This follows when we realize that when an object is instantiated, the memory of its members is first constructed to something before the class constructor code is executed.